This is a reading of The Threefold Social Order by Rudolf Steiner. And this is the foreword as to the purpose of this book. We are confronted by demands for social reconstruction. These pose grave problems with far-reaching implications. This book is written with the conviction that their solution must be looked for along lines not yet considered. Its aim is to show what has to be done in order that social demands coming from a large part of mankind may be turned in the direction of conscious social purpose. Welcome or unwelcome, the facts of social life are present and must be reckoned with. Those who may object to the author's way of discussing proletarian demands should bear this in mind. He wants to present life as it really is. He is aware of the fatal consequences that will result if people refuse to look at the facts. These facts have arisen out of the life of modern mankind. The so-called experts may not be pleased by this approach, which they may feel is not practical. It is their approach, however, that has led to the situation from which mankind is suffering today. They may condemn this book at the start because its opening pages deal less with the economic life than with the spiritual, cultural life of modern mankind. Yet it is the author's conviction, based on experience, that unless people pay close attention to the spiritual, cultural life of today, they will continue to add fresh mistakes to the old ones. On the other hand, what is said here will not altogether please those people who keep repeating that man must rise above absorption in purely material interests, that he must turn to quote-unquote ideals, to the things of the quote-unquote spirit. The author recognizes only that spirituality which forms the substance of man's own life. It shows its power just as much in mastering the problems of practical life as it does in constructing a philosophy that is able to satisfy the needs of man's soul. The important point is not the knowledge or supposed knowledge of a spiritual life, but rather that the spiritual life enables man to grasp realities. The author's point of view may be of special use, since he avoids any aloofness from life. The social question discussed in this book concerns economic life, the rights of men, and the spiritual cultural life. The author endeavors to show how the true form of the social question emerges as an outcome of the requirements of these three aspects of social life. Only through a perception of this can the impulses come that make it possible to give these three branches of social life a shape that can lead to health within the social order. In earlier stages of mankind's evolution, there were social instincts holding these three branches together in a way adapted to the human nature of that period. At present, man is faced with the necessity of working out this combination of functions through conscious social will and purpose. In those countries where the question of a social purpose is most pressing, we find an overlapping and interplay of old instincts and new consciousness. The results of this are quite inadequate for the needs of modern mankind. A great deal of social thinking today is neither clear-sighted nor conscious, because the old instincts are still at work. They weaken men's capacity for understanding and dealing with urgent facts. In the author's opinion, it is necessary to recognize this fully before it is possible to apprehend the forms that the industrial economy, the rights of man, and the spiritual cultural life must take to conform to the demands of the modern age. The following pages indicate the lines that these new forms must inevitably follow. It is a path leading to social ends in keeping with the actual realities and urgent needs of life. The author believes that only through effort in this direction can our social will and purpose surmount mere utopianism and wordy sentiment. If anyone still thinks this book has a somewhat utopian character, he should consider the pictures people draw in their own minds of the kind of society they seek, and how far from life such pictures are. That is the very reason why these people, when they meet with something drawn from reality and experience, look at it as utopian. To many, nothing is concrete that is outside their own customary line of thought. So the concrete itself is an abstraction to them, if it is something about which they are not accustomed to think. Footnote, April 1919. The author has, in the pages which follow, deliberately avoided confining himself to the terms in common use in standard treatises on political economy. He knows quite well the places which a technical economist will pick out as being amateurish. But he has chosen his mode of expression partly because he wishes to address himself also to people who are not familiar with the literature of sociology and economics. But he has done this chiefly because, in his opinion, most of what is peculiarly technical in such writings will be shown by a new age to be incomplete and defective, even in the very form of its expression. It may also be thought that some reference should have been made to other persons whose social ideas bear an incidental resemblance to the author's own. But it must be remembered that in the whole conception presented here, one which the author believes he owes to long years of practical experience, the essential point is not whether a particular thought has taken this or that form. The starting point is the important thing, and the road one takes in giving practical realization to the impulses that underlie this conception. As may be seen from Chapter 4, the author was already doing what he could to implement these ideas in actual practice at a time when ideas that seem somewhat similar had not as yet attracted any attention. End of footnote. Therefore, they will think this book is abstract. With people whose minds are harnessed to a party program, the author's views will also at first find no favor. He is well aware of this, but he believes that it will not be long before many party men come to the conclusion that the actual facts of evolution have gone far beyond the programs of their parties. They will see the urgent necessity of freeing themselves from all such party programs and forming an independent opinion. Preface to the new edition of 1920. Anyone approaching the social problems confronting us with utopian ideas is by that very fact rendered incapable of understanding these problems. Personal views and feelings as to the value of particular solutions are likely to lead a person astray. This would be true even with a perfect theoretical solution that someone might try to press upon his fellow men. It is simply because public life can no longer be affected in such a way. Men today are so constituted that they could never say, quote, "Here is somebody who understands the social institutions that are needed. We will take his opinion and act on it." Unquote. Ideas about social life cannot be brought home to people in such a fashion. That fact is fully recognized in this book, already known to a fairly large public. Those who have set it down as utopian have missed its aim and intention altogether. Such judgments have come especially from people who personally cling to a utopian form of thought. There are many of that sort, particularly in the field of economics, and their prevalence points to an important fact, namely the remoteness of people's thoughts from real life. This is a grave matter, because with such a mode of thought, one cannot hope to master the intricacies of the social problem. Modern man has evolved a spiritual cultural life that is to a great degree dependent on state institutions and on economic forces. While still a child, the human being is brought under the education of the state. Furthermore, he can be educated only in the way permitted by the industrial and economic conditions of his environment. One might easily think that this would result in a person's being well qualified for present-day conditions. One could believe that the state can arrange education, the essence of the spiritual cultural side of public life, in the best interests of the human community. Further, one might suppose that to educate people to fill available jobs in their environment was the best thing that could be done, both for them and for society. It devolves upon this book, an unpopular task, to show that the chaotic condition of our public life comes from the dependence of the spiritual cultural life on the state and on industrial economy, and further, that the setting free of spiritual life from this dependence is one part of the burning social question. This involves attacking widespread errors. For a long time, people have thought of state education as benefiting human progress, and socialistically minded people find it hard to conceive of society not educating the individual to its service, according to its own standards. It is hard to recognize that a thing that was all right at an earlier period of history may later become all wrong. After the Middle Ages, it had been necessary for the state to take over the control of education from those circles which had had exclusive possession of it. But to continue this arrangement is a grave social mistake. This is the content of the first part of the book. A spiritual life did mature to freedom within the framework of the state, but it cannot now rightly enjoy and exercise this freedom unless it is granted self-government. It must become a completely independent branch of the body social, with the educational system under the management of those who are actually engaged in the teaching. There should be no interference from the state or industry. The objection will be raised that even under such a self-government, self-governing spiritual life, things will not be perfect. But in real life, such a thing as perfection is not to be expected. All one can aim for is the best that is possible. The new abilities that children bring with them will really pass into the life of the community when their care rests entirely with people who can judge and decide educational questions on spiritual cultural grounds alone. From such a system, the state and the economic life can receive the forces they need, forces they cannot receive when they themselves shape spiritual life from their own points of view. Thus, the directors of a free spiritual life should also have the responsibility for such things as law schools, trade schools, and technical colleges. The principles expressed in this book are bound to arouse many prejudices, but basically these come from the unconscious conviction that people connected with education must necessarily be impractical and remote from life. People who think in this way do not see that it is just when educators cannot arrange their lines of work themselves that they become impractical. Our antisocial conditions are brought about because people are turned out into social life without having been educated to feel socially. They have been brought up and trained by persons who themselves have been made strangers to real life by having their work laid down from outside. This book will also rouse all sorts of questions in utopian minds. Artists and other spiritual workers will anxiously ask whether genius will find itself better off in the free spiritual life than in the one that the state and the economic powers are providing at present. They should remember that this book is not intended to be utopian. It never lays down a hard and fast theory. It never says this or that must be done this way or that. It aims to promote forms of social life that from their joint working will lead to desirable conditions. Anyone judging life from experience rather than prejudices based on theory will say, quote, "When there is a free spiritual community that provides its own guidance, anyone who is creating out of his own genius will have a prospect of his work being duly appreciated." Unquote. The social question is not something that has just cropped up, nor can it be solved by any handful of people or a parliament and stay solved. It is a part of our recent civilization, and it has come to stay. It will have to be solved over again for each moment of the world's historical evolution. This is because man's life has entered on a phase in which something that starts by being a social institution turns again and again into something antisocial and has in turn to be reconstructed. A human or animal body, having been fed and satisfied, passes again into a state of hunger. Likewise, does the body social go from a state of order again into disorder? There is no universal remedy for social conditions, any more than there is a food that will permanently satisfy the body. But men can enter into forms of social community, which, through their joint action, will bring man's existence constantly back into the social path. One of these is the self-governing spiritual-cultural branch of the body social. Everything going on at the present time makes two social needs obvious: free self-administration for the spiritual-cultural life, and for the economic life, associative labor. The modern industrial economy is made up of the production, circulation, and consumption of commodities. These are the processes for satisfying human wants, and in these processes human beings and their activities are involved. Everyone has a part. Everyone has a part interest in these processes and must share in them as far as he is able. It is only the individual himself who can know and feel what he actually needs. Depending on his insight into the interacting life of the whole, he will judge as to what he himself should accomplish. This was not always so, nor is it so all over the world even today, but it is mainly the case among the civilized portion of mankind. Economic evolution has kept enlarging its circles. The once self-contained household economy developed into a town economy, and this into a state economy. Today we stand before world economy. While the old does, of course, linger on, these sequences are essentially true. It is completely useless to aim at organizing the economic forces into an abstract world community. Private economic organizations have, to a very large extent, become merged in state economic organizations. But the state communities were created by forces other than the purely economic. And the effort to transform the state communities into economic communities is what has brought about the social chaos of these recent times. Economic life is struggling to take the form its own peculiar forces give it, independent of state institutions and of political lines of thought. The only way this form can be realized is through the growth of associations that spring up out of purely economic considerations. These will include consumers, traders, and producers. Their size and scope will be regulated by the actual conditions of life. Those too small would show themselves to be too expensive to operate. Those too large would get beyond the economic grasp of management. Practical needs, as they come up, will show each association the best way of establishing connections with the others. People having to move from one place to another will not be hampered in any way by associations of this kind. They will find it quite easy to move from one group to another when their management is economic and not political. Also, one can conceive possible arrangements within such an associative system that would work with the facility of a money circulation. Within the individual associations, a general harmony of interests can prevail, provided there is a practical sense and technical knowledge. The regulation of the production, circulation, and consumption of goods will not be done by laws, but by the persons concerned, out of their own direct insight and interests. The necessary insight will be developed through people's own share in the life of the associations, and the fact that the various interests are obliged to arrive at a mutual balance by contract will guarantee that the goods circulate at their proper relative values. This sort of economic combination by agreement is not the same as that which exists in the modern labor unions. These are active in the economic field, but they are based on political models. They are political bodies where people debate rather than meet to consider the economic aspects of things and agree on the services to be reciprocally rendered. In these associations, there will not be the quote-unquote wage earners sitting, using their power to get the highest possible wages out of the employers. There will be the manual workers, cooperating with the spiritual workers who direct production, and with those interested as consumers. The mutual aim will be a balance between one form of service and another, brought about through an adjustment of prices. Beware of thinking that this can be done by general debate in parliamentary assemblies. Who would ever be at work if an endless number of people had to spend their time negotiating about the work? Everything will take place by agreement between people and between associations while production continues. The necessary requirement is that the joint agreement be in accordance with the insight of the workers and the interests of the consumers. Saying this is not describing any utopia, for there is no particular way laid down in which this or that question must be settled. One is only pointing out how people will settle matters for themselves once they start working in forms of community that are in accordance with their special insights and interests. Two things work to bring men together into such communities. One of them is human nature, which gives men their wants and needs. The other is a free spiritual life. This will develop the necessary insight in people. Anyone who thinks realistically will admit that associative communities of this kind can spring up at any time. What hinders this development is the notion of organizing industrial and economic life from outside. The kind of economic organization discussed here rests on voluntary, free association and derives its pattern from the combined common sense of each individual. If the haves and the have-nots are together in one organization, it will be found, if no non-economic forces intervene, that the haves are obliged to render the have-nots service for service. While in the free spiritual life only those forces inherent in this life itself will be at work, the only values that count in an associative economic life will be the economic ones that grow up under the associations. The individual's part in economic life will become clear to him from living and working along with his economic associates, and the weight he carries in the economic system will be in exact proportion to the service he renders within it. How those who are unfitted to render service will find their place in the general economy is discussed later in this book. Thus, the body social falls into two independent branches, able to afford each other mutual support, owing to the fact that each has its own administration and management. Between these two must come a third. This is the true state branch of the body social. Here all those things find a place that depend on the combined judgment and feelings of every person of voting age. In the free spiritual cultural life, everyone is active in line with his special abilities. In the economic, each person fills the place that falls to him as a result of his connection with the rest of the associative network. In the political state life of rights, each comes into his own as a human being. He stands on his simple human value. This has nothing to do with his abilities in the free spiritual life and is independent, too, of whatever value the associative economic system may set on the goods he produces. Hours of labor and working conditions are shown in this book to be matters for the political rights life, for the state. Here everyone meets on an equal footing, because the activities and functions of control are limited to fields in which all men alike are competent to form an opinion. This is the branch of the body social where men's rights and duties are adjusted. The unity of the body social will come into being out of the separate free expansion of its three functions. In the course of this book, it is shown what form the energies of capital and of the means of production, as well as the use of land, can take under the joint action of these three functions of the social organism. The book was first published in April 1919. Since then, I have presented a series of explanatory articles, now in a separate volume, footnote, In Elaboration of the Threefold Commonwealth, end footnote. The ideas in this book have been won from the observation of life. It is out of this observation of actual life that they ask to be understood. That's the end of the first section of the reading of the Threefold Social Order by Rudolf Steiner.